This episode of the Friday Fix is brought to you by the GoDaddy coupon CJC Sigler C, which gets you a brand new .com domain for just 99 cents. .comify your name, the name of your kid, or that dream business you plan to start someday. Just 99 cents for a .com with coupon code CJCSIGLERC at GoDaddy.com. Find more money-saving GoDaddy codes at scottsigler.com/GoDaddy. And now on with our Friday Fix. From Empty Set Studios in San Diego, California, welcome to the Friday Fix. Hello, junkies. Welcome to another Friday Fix. It is I, your future Dark Overlord, Scott Sigler. A Real Girl, the director of Doom, is not with us for this particular podcast, but we have a guest. We have author Thomas Mullen, author of Darktown. Thomas, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So Thomas is joining us from Atlanta, I believe. Is that correct?
That's correct. Atlanta, Georgia.
Home of Dragon Con, where I go every year. Thomas, with your style of books, is Dragon Con something that you frequent?
Well, unfortunately, Dragon Con is the same weekend as the big Decatur Book Festival, which is Atlanta's big festival. So I have gone to Dragon Con as a spectator pedestrian a few times with my two little boys. So okay. We get to watch the stormtroopers and people walk by.
And have they dressed up at all for the costumes?
Yeah, you know, it's been a couple years. I don't think they did. And I haven't gone the last couple years because it's just gotten so incredibly crowded. I want to wait till they're a little larger and less likely to be crushed by a mob.
Yeah, we don't want that to happen with the little ones, unless they are dressed like rebel scum, in which case let's just get them off the street because they don't really belong here. Today we're going to talk to you about your book Darktown, which is a suspense novel. My fans may not be familiar with you, so let's start right out of the gate. Give us an overview of Darktown.
So Darktown is a murder mystery set in 1948 when the city of Atlanta finally hired its first 8 black police officers. And I came across this fact years ago when I was reading a book about Atlanta history. And what jumped out at me was this. Because it was only 3 years after World War II, it was still the Jim Crow era. So in order to make the hiring of black cops palatable to the white majority, these 8 gentlemen were given certain restrictions on what they could and couldn't do. Mm-hmm. So they were police officers, but they could only patrol the black sections of town. They could not drive squad cars. They had to walk their beat. They couldn't even use the headquarters because 1/4 of Atlanta cops were Klansmen, according to a recent Newsweek article. So the police chief was afraid that if these 8 black men in uniform showed their faces in the headquarters, white officers would riot and attack them. So instead, they had to operate their own little precinct in the basement of the black YMCA. Wow. And last but not least, they could not arrest white people. So when I read all that, I just thought it would be a great setting for a murder mystery that follows 2 black rookies and 2 white cops during the investigation of a crime that seems to cross racial lines.
So right out of the gate, considering our current political climate, this strikes me as a fantastic screenplay opportunity. The book's only been out a couple weeks, but has there been any interest in adapting this for films right now?
We've optioned the rights to Sony Television, and Jamie Foxx has signed on to be a co-executive producer, or an executive producer, I should say. So, yeah, people were interested in film and television, and we decided to go with TV because I see this as the first book in a series. Because 48 is right before the first key victories of the Civil Rights Movement, and because so much is going to change over the next 20 years, I thought this would be fun to write, you know, as a series that, mm-hmm. that takes maybe 20 years and traces all of the changes that the Civil Rights Movement will bring to Atlanta. So because I saw it as a book series, I thought it would work as a TV series.
This is the South. These gentlemen, these 8 black cops who took on this job, must have understood they were breaking norms and doing something very important at the same time, putting themselves in significant personal danger by doing something that had never been done before. Were they aware of the difficulty they were stepping into to do this job?
I think they were. I mean, according to the research that I did, I found interviews with some of the original. They've all passed away at this point, mm-hmm. but I was able to find some interviews recorded in the 80s when a couple of them were veteran officers. And, you know, I found a lot of, you know, old articles written like 20-year-later retrospectives, 30-year-later retrospectives. you know, if the question is, do they know what they were getting into? I don't know if anyone fully can, but I think they all recognize that this is a big opportunity. Mm-hmm. Atlanta's black community had been asking mayors for black cops for decades. So the fact that they finally were able to have eight officers was a big deal. And I think in real life, seven of the first eight cops were World War II veterans. Okay. So, you know, a lot of black men came back from World War II. They had been allowed to serve as soldiers. And, you know, it made sense that these men would want to then be cops. But at the same time, they were in for a lot. Most of the white cops were very against them. They received a lot of, you know, horrible treatment from white cops. There's a lot of things in the book that I did not make up, such as the white cops making monkey and orangutan and gorilla sounds around the black cops, the white cops using racial epithets around the black cops. Some of the white cops would try to run over a black cop if he happened to cross the street in front of them. And one cop even put a $200 bounty on the black cops' heads. So they may have intellectually understood that it was going to be a very difficult job, but I'm sure it had to still have been even harder than they imagined.
So let's revisit here. This is a fictionalized account of a true story, true to life story. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Yes. So these gentlemen get into this, and they, as you've mentioned, they knew they were getting into some level of difficulty. If they knew the full expanse of the difficulty they're getting into, there's no way of knowing. But this was a pivotal moment for their culture in Atlanta and probably nationally. I don't know what the picture was for black police officers nationally, but did they get into this primarily because their justice wasn't being served in their community? If you were a victim of crime and you were black, was your difficulties, your trials largely ignored by law enforcement at the time?
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure there were a lot of reasons why the job appealed to them, but one, yes. You know, for the most part, the black areas of Atlanta weren't really policed. You know, white cops might show up if they wanted to find a suspect to pin a crime on, mm-hmm. rightfully or wrongfully. But Atlanta at that time had a very economically vibrant black community. There's a neighborhood called Sweet Auburn, which was where Martin Luther King Jr. was raised. And it had million-dollar black-owned banks, million-dollar black-owned insurance companies. Mm-hmm. It had successful entrepreneurs, preachers, doctors, dentists, professors. So, you know, if you were a black business owner, you felt like you didn't have much protection from pickpockets, from thieves. If you ran a restaurant or a nightclub, you worried about the people that hung out in the back alley that might rough up your customers. So the black community, you know, desperately wanted cops. And then, of course, there was the issue of police brutality, something that, you know, we still see today. But especially back then, there were lots of accusations about, you know, white cops just beating up black people and mistreating them. So they wanted black officers, you know, to protect them, to give them enforcement of the law, but also to, you know, cut down on white police brutality.
So your book focuses on a black woman who vanishes, last seen in a car that is driven by a white man. Mm-hmm. And your primary characters are Boggs and Smith. And these gentlemen have to follow this case, and yet they cannot arrest whites if they are to find any crime. Can you describe, from the perspective of our main characters, what they are up against?
Sure. And I should point out, too, the book, it follows four main characters, two black, two white. So we could sort of see both sides of the mm-hmm. investigation and both sides of Jim Crow. But in the first chapter, the two black officers see a car being driven erratically. And so they pull it over and they see to their surprise that it's a white driver, which they hadn't expected because this is the black part of town late at night. But the white driver's passenger is a young black woman. And it looks like she's been struck in the face. But the driver, you know, he tells them off. He's like, you have no power over me. You know, you're only black cops. You can't do anything. And he drives away. They manage to call in two white cops to assist in the arrest. And those are the two white cops that the book will then follow. But those two white officers, they just let the driver go. One of them even jokes around with the driver. They have a few laughs and they let him drive off. They don't even get his name. And then 2 days later, Boggs and Smith, the two black rookies, they find her body shot and dumped in an alley. So, you know, what happened that night? Were the two white cops involved? Why did they let the white driver go? What was going on there? And more to the point, how could Boggs and Smith possibly investigate this? You know, they're just beat cops. Mm-hmm. They're not homicide detectives. They aren't investigators. In fact, none of the black cops would be promoted until the early 60s. So, you know, I was really intrigued by that. You know, as a storyteller, there were a lot of obstacles, just like there were a lot of obstacles to Boggs and Smith, there were a lot of obstacles to me as a writer figuring out how would they even do this. I mean, they can't follow a white suspect through a white part of town. They can't knock on the front door of a white witness. Mm-hmm. You know, they can't really do anything. So, but you know, they're going to try. They're going to try to find a way. And that was a challenge. That's a challenge that they faced. It was a challenge that I faced too.
Yeah, I mean, aside from the civil rights implications and the historical landmark that this was, at least for the Atlanta community and larger, setting that aside, as a fellow storyteller, this just absolutely leaps out at me to be like, "Holy wow, what a great story to tell." A huge part of suspense and even horror is limited possibilities, limited options that you can do.
Yeah.
And you're starting out with characters that are probably being harassed on a regular basis to not do their job to the best of the ability, but are out for justice for this woman that has been murdered. And man, they are up against it. I mean, how did you come across this story? And at the same time, how on earth has this story not been told as a fictional story before? Where did you find this?
Well, you hit a lot of points there, but I want to first completely agree with what you said about, you know, how the restrictions and limitations are what force you to be creative as a storyteller sometimes. And that's what intrigued me when I saw all the restrictions I had to work under. I was like, that is such a unique environment. And you mentioned horror, you know, science fiction, anything. As a reader, you want this like fully realized world that has all of its rules and strange protocols and etiquettes and things like that. It helps that world come alive for the reader. And so, as terrible as the Jim Crow South was, when I realized all the rules that these men had to operate under, I found like I'd stumbled upon a really fascinating world. As for how I heard about it, you know, I moved to Atlanta 8 years ago, so as a relative newcomer to the area, I'd been reading a lot about Atlanta history, mm-hmm. and I was in the middle of a 600-page book that traced 150 years of Atlanta history, and in the middle, I came upon a 3-page passage, you know, about, you know, the political circumstances behind the hiring of the first 8 black ops, and then all those Jim Crow restrictions they had to work under, and that was really what struck me. I mean, I was like, I can't believe they had to be cops while having, you know, one hand tied behind their backs.
Sure.
And as a storyteller, there was so much there I thought I could play with.
Even with the current difficulties they were having with the African-American community and law enforcement, this still feels so alien to people of our generation to be like, wait, what do you mean the first black cops? We're far enough removed from that time that to even go back and, I mean, logically, of course, there was a time where there were no black cops and the first black cops had to come in. Of course, they're under obstacles, but to get into it in a storytelling narrative as you have it, it lets it really hit home from a personal perspective to go out of our own time, land on this alien planet, which is our planet, where people are completely marginalized and can't get basic, you don't even have a shot at justice until these gentlemen show up. Tell me about what were your emotions like as a modern day American going back and experiencing something that our grandparents and even possibly our parents as children could have gone through?
I mean, it's definitely disturbing. I mean, a lot of people have asked me, what shocked you when you did the research? And I don't know that anything really shocked me because, I mean, I majored in American history. I studied a lot of 20th century American history and studied the civil rights movement. I've been reading about it for a long time. So there are even yet more shocking stories than this out there, mm-hmm. certainly. But I think one of the things that I love about fiction is that it can really bring to life or bring home some of the emotional impact that you might not always get when you're reading nonfiction. Mm-hmm. So you might read a book of history that tells you about all the horrible things that went on in this time period. But when you read a novel and you get to, you know, walk that road and be in somebody else's eyes, it feels a little bit more powerful. And so, you know, it was an interesting experience for me to be on, to go through that, but also to be on both sides. I mean, it was a challenge to bring some of these characters to life because, like you say, it is such a foreign world, mm-hmm. but trying to recreate the white characters was every bit as challenging. I mean, 1948 in the Jim Crow South, that's nothing like any world I've ever lived in. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I had to do a lot of research to figure out, you know, what all the characters were going through and how did they think and what were their obstacles and what were like the boundaries around what was and wasn't conceivable back then.
Which was harder for you, to write as a Jim Crow white man perspective or as a Jim Crow black man's perspective?
I don't know if either was harder, but they were both very difficult. And, you know, it was important to me to make sure that all of the characters were very three-dimensional and fully formed and felt very real. And so by having two black protagonists and two white protagonists, I was able to make sure that they all had very different personalities. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not like White Cop A and B or Black Cop A and B. The two black protagonists, Boggs and Smith, one of them comes from a very privileged background. His dad's a preacher. He's a Morehouse graduate. He's never had to ride in the back of a bus because his parents own a car. And, you know, he knows about racism, obviously, because he's a black man back then, but he hasn't had too many horrible experiences personally, whereas his partner was raised poor. He's had to navigate these potentially dangerous interactions every day of his life. So both characters were difficult to pull off. But I think by making sure that every character is unique and different, and again, the two white cops, one of them is a racist, violent thug. The other one fashions himself a racial progressive. But then again, it's still 1948 in the South. So how progressive is he really?
Right, right.
You know, it was a way to, you know, bring different philosophies and different personalities to light.
Now, in our current social media world and our social justice alert online lives, you know, there can be concerns. You're telling a very deeply personal story to the African-American community, and yet you are a white writer. Did you have any concerns about how to approach that, or like how do I do this in the right way, that I'm not just co-opting something? And also, secondary question, was there concern you would get any pushback from the black community to be like, this isn't your story to tell?
Yeah, absolutely. I thought about these things a lot and thinking about them a lot now that the book is out and people get to read it. I don't think I could have or even would have tried to write this book, you know, 17 years ago when I was in my early 20s and had lived all my life in Rhode Island and Boston in overwhelmingly white communities. But, you know, the last 16 years or so of my life, I've lived in Atlanta, North Carolina, in Washington, D.C. I've lived in racially diverse areas. I mean, I have a racially mixed family. I think just the world I live in today, it's just because I'm a white writer, I don't want to write about characters who are all white. I don't think that's the real world. And when I read a book or see a TV show and everyone in it is white, you know, I ask myself, what world is this? Because this doesn't look like the world I live in. I don't understand. So, you know, I think writing is all about empathy and, you know, like I mentioned before, seeing the world through somebody else's eyes. So, you know, when you read fiction, you can see what it was like to have been a person that's, you know, a different race from you, maybe a different gender, different class background, could be from a different planet if it's sci-fi, different time period. I think that's one of the great things about fiction. We can take that empathetic leap. But, you know, how can I, as a writer, expect my readers to take that empathetic leap if I don't even do it, if all the characters are just white male stand-ins for myself? Mm-hmm. And I think that if you start saying that, you know, white male authors should only write about white men, and, you know, maybe straight white men should only write about straight white men, and straight white men from New England who moved to the South should probably only write about straight, then it's getting narrower and narrower and narrower. And then we're all basically writing memoir.
Yeah.
Or we're all writing that particular kind of fiction that's really thinly veiled autobiography. And on the one hand, that does describe a lot of writers who I love and admire and whose books are all over my bookshelves. But if that was the only kind of fiction that was being written, I think the art form would be weaker for it. And I think we as readers would be worse off. And last, I should just say too, I mean, it is a racially diverse book. There are four protagonists, two black, two white. So if you want to put, you know, race restrictions on who can write what, no one would be able to write a book like that. Mm-hmm. We wouldn't have books with, you know, multiracial casts. And I think that too would be unfortunate.
As a author who writes primarily completely fictional work, like science fiction or far future, where I get to create the worlds and talk about the different people in the worlds, there's a lot more leeway there for me because I'm inventing the cultures that I am talking about. Immersing yourself years ago in Atlanta, you probably found, I'm guessing you found certain rules or certain structures that you had to like, oh, I wasn't expecting this particular framework. And then you had to write within the framework to make sure you're being sensitive to all sides. Was there anything like that for you?
When I said I couldn't have written this a long time ago, I mean, over the years, I've done a lot of research into this. I've read a lot about the civil rights movement and Atlanta and mid-century America. And, you know, the more you read, you know, the more nonfiction and memoirs and fiction, you learn people's stories. You learn about some of the things. You learn about the incredible diversity of life and all the different stories that people have lived. You learn what kind of jobs people work, what kind of backgrounds people had. And, you know, all those little things you know, that's fuel that helps you. So, you know, a lot of the characters in this book, you know, are based on little things that I learned here and there. You know, one example would be that there's a minor character, but he's got a couple of great scenes. Boggs has an uncle who is a writer. He's one of the best-selling black writers in America, but nobody knows he's black because he writes under a pen name. Okay. And he writes these books that are kind of these antebellum adventure, like Last of the Mohegan type stories. And he's a very self-loathing man. He lives in Paris now because you know, Paris was considered a better place to live if you were black. They treated African-Americans better there. But he comes back to the South once a year. And when he comes back, he gets horribly depressed and he drinks a lot and he tries to kill himself. Well, I modeled that after the fact that there was indeed back then one of the best-selling black writers in America was a black author who wrote under a pseudonym and no one knew he was black. And when I learned about that and when I learned about the kind of books he read, you know, it fascinated me. That's an interesting story. It's something I would not have guessed. And it helped me come up with the idea for that character. So I think, you know, people are going to write stereotypes if they don't know much about what they're writing about. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's kind of what a stereotype is. It's a thin, two-dimensional idea of what a person is really like. And so, you know, when I mentioned doing the research, and this is something that I've been thinking about for so long, and I've read widely and talked to a lot of people, it just, you learn more about, you know, just the diversity of people. And by, I mean, like, how everyone is unique and there's so many different things we have lived. And I get to use all of those different life experiences to try to build these characters who feel unique and feel real.
A question I usually ask on this show is if you can describe three books that people may or may not have read that are close to this. I mean, I hear this and I kind of get a feel of LA Confidential, where we're talking about this is some serious hardcore racism going on within law enforcement. And telling that story in a no punches pulled perspective. Is it in that ballpark of James Ellroy, or what would you compare it to as a creator?
Yeah, it's been compared to Ellroy a lot. And I've actually not read LA Confidential. I've certainly seen the movie, but I've read a lot of his books. I mean, he's an amazing writer. He's a great stylist. He has a darker worldview than I do. Mm-hmm. So I only hesitate to compare myself to him. I mean, he's a great, great writer. He's a master and I love him. And yes, there are a lot of bad things that happen in this book, certainly. But I think there's a little bit more optimism about human character in my book than you'll find in his. But yeah, the book gets compared to Ellroy a lot. People have compared it to some, you know, Dennis Lehane novels, mm-hmm. or Richard Price, who was one of the main writers for The Wire, and he just wrote The Night Of, the HBO show. But he's also written some great novels about cops in New York.
Okay.
I kind of pitched it at one point as The Wire meets In the Heat of the Night, because mm-hmm. it's a lot about police and about, you know, the lives that they lead and how they do their jobs, but also about race in the South.
So let's get into you a little bit as an author. In 2006, your book, The Last Town on Earth, was named the best debut novel of 2006 by USA Today and won the James Fenimore Cooper Prize for Excellent in Historical Fiction. That was 10 years ago. You come out of the gate swinging. You're rocking, you're rolling, you're nailing big awards, getting a lot of props.
Felt good.
I'm sure it did. In the decade that followed, you've done a total of 5 books now, it looks like.
And no, this is the fourth.
This is the fourth book. So you've done 4 books. How have you as a writer changed from that debut novel, and then you progressed through your career? How have you changed as a writer from 2006 to 2016?
Man, that's a good question. How have I changed? I'm sure I've changed in a lot of ways. So that first book was historical, as is this. And if somebody had told me that, you know, 3 of my first 4 books would be historical fiction, I would have thought they were crazy. Mm-hmm. And when I was trying to get published, I was writing, you know, contemporary books set in the present time about young people, dealing with young people problems. I loved David Foster Wallace and Dave Eggers, you know, long, crazy sentences, very caffeinated prose and lots of swears and things like that. But none of those stories got published. And I had the idea for this historical novel, and I mentioned it to my agent. I'd always assumed historical fiction would be like, you know, my mature third novel, because a lot of writers do that. They write a couple of books that are kind of maybe funny, contemporary, and then they wow the critics with their historical epic third novel. Mm-hmm. But my agent said, I like that idea. Do that now. And I said something like, probably what I just did. And I was like, well, can I do that now? And she said, why not? You know, I believe in you. I think you have talent. Do it. So that was very encouraging. And I think, you know, her response and the fact that that book did get, you know, it got a good amount of praise, it was encouraging, and it made me not want to be afraid or not be intimidated by certain ideas. So the last few books I've done, you know, I've bended some genres. One book kind of combined it, hard-boiled detective 30s fiction with magical realism. My last book had a little bit of dystopian, is that got a time traveler in it, mm-hmm. but crossed with a post 9/11 spy novel. So I think for a while there, I was trying different things, and my first three books were all very, very different from each other. And I liked that. You know, I felt like as an artist, I didn't want to get put in a box. And you know, artistically, that's well and good, but I will say, and here's one way I think I've changed. I've learned that, you know, there are downsides to people not knowing what box to put you in and to writing books that are all very, very, very different from each other. Because mm-hmm. my first three really were different from each other. So with Darktown, because I like this idea so much and I'm so interested in this time period going from 48 to 68, this was a deliberate decision on my part to write a series, to stop jumping around in time and stop jumping around in genre and stop jumping around in settings, which I'd done before, and say, okay, I'm going to write a few books set in Atlanta during the civil rights movement. They're going to be crime stories. They're going to be murder mysteries. But I don't feel like that's limiting at all. Like even though it's a genre, I feel like there's so many different things I can do with this. So I think I've changed in that sense that instead of being overly self-conscious about wanting to do things so differently each time, I see the merit in almost like having a beat. And be so okay. Instead of people saying, who's Thomas Lane? What does he write again? What are his books like? But, oh, yeah, he's that Southern civil rights era crime writer.
And you feel very comfortable in this space.
I do right now. Maybe I'll get bored in 5 or 6 years or after 5 or 6 books. I don't know. And I don't know how many books I have in me for this. I'm not sure. But okay. I certainly know, as I did research for this, I mean, there's so many great stories and so many great historical backdrops. This book easily could have been an 800-page doorstop of a novel mm-hmm. if I'd let that happen, because I kept coming up with great subplots and characters. But I realized, you know, instead of overstuffing this book, you know, I'm going to hold back. You know, I learned that Atlanta had a homegrown fascist organization in the late 40s called the Columbians. They dressed up like Nazis. They wore brown shirts. They had SS lightning bolts on their sleeves. Mm. And they made a point of showing up whenever a black family tried to buy a house in a white neighborhood. They would show up to scare them off. And so at one point, I was writing them into Darktown. And then finally, I decided, you know, this is just too much. It's too many subplots. So now that's book two. So, you know, I learned there's a lot of benefits to having a series. I think I might have looked kind of sideways at series before, or just mm-hmm. not. I just wasn't personally interested in writing one. But now I really, really am, because I think it gives me the freedom to, you know, not overstuff a book and just sort of take things one at a time.
And also from a business perspective, the way the entertainment industry works now, there's the great historical meat that you're digging into. There is the personal satisfaction of writing about something that should be brought to attention, brought back in the modern era. There's also the concept of a franchise character. And franchise characters, as authors, as a lot of authors know, there is more sales opportunities and adaptation and adaptation opportunities in franchise characters. Did you find particular characters that you resonate with in this that you will carry through? Is it Boggs and Smith, or could you continue to show all the perspective of all four of these, both black and white cops, as time changes and things move on in Atlanta?
No, a little of both. I think you're right that if somebody likes a book and there's going to be another one in the series, you kind of expect that protagonist to stick around. So I finished a draft of the next book, and it follows, without giving anything away, it follows the characters who survived this book. Mm-hmm. So it's there isn't too big of a switch from book one to book two. But for book three, I'm already thinking about, you know, I might want to hold on to one or two of the protagonists, but I might want to take somebody who is a side character. For example, the first 8 black cops in Atlanta, they had a white sergeant. And this white sergeant had to work in the black precinct, in the basement of the black Y, in the black part of town. That could not have been a very comfortable position for that one white cop. And in fact, in real life, he didn't want the job at all. But over time, he came to like the job and like the cops that he worked with. Hmm. So he's a minor character in this book, but I do like the idea of giving him a lead role in the future. But for now, yeah, Boggs and Smith are guys that I want to stick around with for a little bit. And while at the same time, you know, I like the fact that because there are other cops, I could possibly sort of move the spotlight to the side in a future book and use a different character as a main character.
And the last question for you, we're heading into a very, very difficult election, and there's a lot of different political perspectives in the landscape right now. And I'm not going to ask you to settle on anything in particular there, but looking at where we are now with the difficulties the African-American community has with law enforcement and Black Lives Matter and this hotly contested election, are there things from Darktown that are like, we've completely forgotten the lessons we learned from the time in which you were writing the book? Or do you see positive developments and beneficial change?
I see both. I think people who read this book will certainly see how far Atlanta has come. In fact, you know, one fear I have is that people, especially maybe in the Northeast, will read this book and think, oh my God, Atlanta is a terrible place. I mean, Atlanta today is quite different than in 1948, like amazingly different. So on the one hand, anyone who reads this book, I'm sure, will come away at least partly with a sense of, wow, we've come a long way. It's so much better now. While at the same time, as you say, these are issues that continue to resonate. These are still issues we're dealing with as a country. I started this book 4 years ago, which was 2 years before Michael Brown was killed and Ferguson exploded. And, you know, the issue of race and policing became such a major media news story. I hadn't, you know, anticipated that. But at the same time, I knew that these are issues that have always been important. You know, race and power have been fundamental issues in America since, you know, before our founding, and they always have been, mm-hmm. and it probably will be for a very long time. So I hope that people reading the book, you know, do feel some comfort to see how far we've come. But at the same time, they're going to see that there's nothing that we're going through now that is without, you know, historical precedent, without precursor. That the issues that we're dealing with, there is a lot of, you know, there's a lot of things that have happened in the past that have led us to where we are today. And, you know, I was recently reading a great book by, you know, by Brian Stevenson called Just Mercy. He's a death penalty attorney, and he talks about a lot of cases he worked on in the 80s and 90s with the great miscarriages of justice that resulted in Black men being put away and put on the death penalty for crimes they didn't commit. And, you know, at one point he says, you know, when you face these stories every day, you certainly understand why there's been historically a lot of mistrust of the legal system in the African American community, because it has so frequently been used against them unjustifiably. And that is going to take a long time to go away, but it's certainly not going to go away if you continue to have the sorts of problems we're having now. So, you know, we've come a long way, but we still have a lot further to go.
Thomas, thank you for being on the show. Where do people go to find out more about you?
My website is thomasmullen.net. It's Mullen with an E and no S, thomasmullen.net. And Darktown should be available wherever fine books are found.
Great. Thank you for being on the show, sir.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to The Friday Fix, a production of Empty Set Entertainment. Want to hear more of Scott Sigler? Find his fiction in bookstores everywhere or at Amazon.com. And tune into his weekly fiction podcast to get free, serialized, unabridged audiobooks. Get the podcast at ScottSigler.com or subscribe directly through iTunes at ScottSigler.com/iTunes.